Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ana Mateo and Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this report.
The United States has a long history of systemic inequality in its treatment of minorities, especially African Americans. Now, a new study suggests that higher education is yet another part of American society that treats Black people unfairly. The study comes from the University of Southern California's Race and Equity Center, which released its findings in September. Researchers from the center looked at information from the U.S. Department of Education's Integrated Post-Secondary Data System. This is a database of information gathered from every college and university in the U.S. that accepts federal financial assistance. The researchers also looked at population data from the U.S. Census Bureau. The center's researchers used data from the 2016-2017 school year to examine four qualities of most of the country's public colleges and universities. They did not include community colleges or public historically Black colleges and universities. One quality the study examined was the percentage of Black undergraduate students. Researchers looked to see if it matched the overall college-aged Black population in the school's home state. Researchers also considered the percentages of Black male and Black female students attending each school. They compared those to the national percentages of male and female university students of all racial and ethnic groups. The third quality under study was a school's rate of graduation among Black students within 6 years of their entry and how it compared to overall graduation rates at the school. And finally, researchers looked at the number of full-time Black professors in relation to the number of Black students.
The University of Southern California's researchers graded all four qualities of the schools on a scale from 0 to 4. A 4 meant the school is serving African American students in the best way possible in a given area. The researchers took the average of those grades and gave them an overall grade on the same scale. Then they combined the grades of all the schools they looked at in a state, using the averages to give each of the 50 states an overall grade as well. All 50 states received a grade of less than 3. Sean Harper says this shows just how poorly the U.S.'s public higher education system is serving African Americans. He is the executive director of the Race and Equity Center, and he helped write the report. Sure, there are many institutions that are relatively high-performing on one or two of the metrics, Harper told VOA. But when we look across all four metrics, there are very few colleges and universities that really stand out. Harper notes that most colleges and universities have tried to increase diversity as well as help the success of minority students. And he admits that they have improved conditions for minorities overall. However, schools have done little to solve the specific problems individual racial and ethnic groups face, he argues. He says African Americans have traditionally faced many barriers to higher education. He says many grow up in areas where public education is severely lacking in financial resources and other supports at the high school level and below. So African Americans have to work harder to reach higher education. And once they get there, non-black professors are likely to treat them as though they will not succeed, Harper says. Mike Baumgartner is the executive director of Nebraska's Coordinating Commission for Post-Secondary Education. The report listed that state second to last in the country in terms of how well it serves African American students. Baumgartner notes that earlier this year, the research group The Education Trust praised his state's efforts to improve its service of black students. The group found that Nebraska had the largest gains in numbers of black students successfully earning college degrees of any state since 2000.
But he also admits that the report represents an unacceptable failure on the part of Nebraska's public colleges and universities. And he says the state must do what it can to solve this major problem. Baumgartner says a big part of the problem is geographic. He notes that most of the African Americans in his state live in the larger cities. Some of the public colleges serve small, local communities far from students' homes and families. And for black professors, these communities are so small their husbands or wives may have trouble finding employment. The rural nature of the state and the fact that some of our colleges are pretty far away from the population centers makes it difficult for them to retain the African American students, Baumgartner said. However, Harper says that is an unacceptable answer. He argues that African Americans pay taxes that support public colleges and universities. So the schools have a responsibility to reach out to high schools across their state and try to get black students to want to study there. Jessica Cruz says that is exactly why her position was created in 2016. She is the Chief Diversity Officer at Northern Michigan University in Marquette, Michigan. The Race and Equity Center's report listed her school second to last in the nation in terms of how well it serves African American students. Cruz has already begun to take several actions suggested by Sean Harper and the report to improve the situation. For example, her school is home to a group called the Black Student Union, which operates a program called BSU on Wheels. It sends current African American students in Marquette to high schools in Detroit, Michigan, about 600 kilometers southeast. There, they share their college experiences with younger students.
Cruz also recently launched a program called AIM North. Once her school admits students from the Detroit area, the program connects them with one another and helps them build a sense of community at their new school. Still, she notes, barriers remain that can prevent black students from feeling like they belong at such a rural school like Northern Michigan University. With the community being predominantly white, we are not going to have the same kinds of services available that you would have in a place like Detroit or Grand Rapids. Food, hair products and hair services, and religion. Things like that, said Cruz. Hillary Shelton is the head of the Washington, D.C. office of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, one of the U.S.'s oldest civil rights groups. He says he fully agrees with the report's findings on the failings of public schools, but he says there are additional problems that the report did not examine. A major barrier, he says, is cost. In 2016, the U.S. Census Bureau found that Black households have had the lowest average yearly earnings out of any racial group since 1967. And about 22% of African Americans live below the poverty level, again, more than any other group. African Americans have long depended on financial assistance, like that from the federal Pell Grant system to help pay for higher education, says Shelton. But in recent years, the cost of college has severely increased and the value of such aid has decreased. We have still not caught up with the spending power of the Pell Grant, even from the 1960s, to make sure that students have what they need to actually pay their tuition, he said. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we talk about expressions in American English and often explore their meanings in depth. And today, we visit the exciting world of live theater. The world of Broadway and live theater have given us many expressions, and several come from part of the stage, the place where plays, musicals, and other stage shows are performed. For example, in a theater, the wings are the hidden areas to the left and right of the stage. This is where actors wait before they make an appearance. So an actor waiting in the wings is standing off stage, waiting to perform. But the expression, waiting in the wings, is not just used in the world of theater. It can also mean someone is ready to enter a situation, be brought to public attention, or take a job or position. For example, you can use it in a business setting. Let's say the head of a company is nearing the end of her career. She has been training her assistant to take her place when she retires. So you could say, her assistant is waiting in the wings to take control of the business. Now let's go back to the stage. People other than actors can stand in the wings of a theater. Often actors on stage forget their lines. So it is a good idea to have someone else standing in the wings holding a script. He or she could say the forgotten lines to the actor without the audience hearing or seeing them. Actors who forget many of their lines may not have prepared very well. And that is where we get the expression, to wing it. When you wing it, you do something, or try to do something, without much preparation. There are other expressions that mean about the same as winging it. If I say something off the cuff, or off the top of my head, I say it without thinking. Now, no expression in the theater world is more iconic than "the show must go on."
It's clear that every one of you is in perfect physical condition, so the show must go on.
Why?
Because, as old as time itself, there's a grand theatrical tradition that the show must go on.
This saying means that no matter what happens, even if all the performers' costumes get lost at the cleaners, or the lead actor gets food poisoning, the show will be performed. This represents the heart of theater people. They will do whatever it takes to put the show on. It also means that no one is more important than the show. If something should happen to an actor, someone must be ready and able to take their place. That is why actors in live theater performances have standbys. Also called understudies, these people do not perform every day, but they are ready to step into one or more parts should they be needed. So there are actors who are on standby, waiting in the wings for their turn. But we can all find ourselves on standby. A standby is anyone who is ready to step in when needed, especially in an emergency. For example, if a hospital is expecting to treat many wounded people, they may have many doctors, nurses, and ambulances on standby. Besides emergencies, we also commonly use this word in airline travel. A person on standby is on a waiting list. They wait for an available, unreserved seat on an airplane. Used as an adjective, there are standby passengers and standby tickets. Standby as a verb means to be waiting but ready to act. But keep in mind that this sounds very official. We probably would not tell our family and friends to stand by, unless it was an emergency or as part of an important event. We should mention another important way we use stand by. When we stand by people, we give them the support they need to get through a difficult time. It is important to stand by your family and friends. And that's Words in Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Ulysses S. Grant. He took office in 1869, but his presidency is not what made him famous. Grant is best remembered for being the commander of Union forces at the end of the Civil War. He led the United States to victory over the Confederate States of America. Many Americans also remember Grant because of the unusual story about his middle initial. When the future 18th president was born, his parents named him Hiram Ulysses Grant, but the boy was known as Ulysses. When Grant was a young man, a member of Congress appointed him to a top college, the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, New York. The congressman did not know Grant personally. He thought Grant used his mother's family name, Simpson, as his middle name. So the congressman called him Ulysses S. Grant. The middle initial S became official. Years later, Grant joked that it did not mean anything. During the Civil War, however, Grant's middle name did come to have a popular meaning. In a famous battle in the state of Tennessee, Grant's army overpowered their opponents. The Confederate general sent a note asking for the terms of surrender. In other words, what would the Union Army require of them if they withdrew from the battle? General Grant replied, no terms except unconditional and immediate surrender. The answer did not please the Confederate general, but he agreed. In the North, people celebrated the victory. They began saying Grant's first two initials stood for unconditional surrender. Grant was born in the state of Ohio. He was the oldest of six children. Grant's father worked as a tanner, a person who makes leather from animal skin. As a boy, Grant helped his father, but he did not like the work. He said he would not do it when he was an adult. So, when Grant was a young man, his father asked West Point officials to admit his son as a student. The Grants had little money to pay for the boy's college education, but they knew he was intelligent and skilled, and West Point was free. In exchange for their education, West Point graduates serve in the military. Grant probably did not seem like a soldier. He was quiet and sensitive. He hated seeing men die in battle, and he questioned the value of war. But he turned out to be an excellent military leader. After he graduated from West Point, he fought in the Mexican War and earned medals for bravery. He was given more power and added responsibilities. However, Grant was lonely. Early in his career, he married Julia Dent, the sister of a college friend. He was devoted to Julia and their four children. But his family could not come with Grant on all his deployments for the military. They were separated for years at a time. Without his family nearby, Grant began having problems with money. Some people said he also drank too much alcohol. One day, Grant resigned from the Army. He returned home to his family. At first, he tried to farm, but he could not make enough money. Then he tried other jobs. Finally, he asked his father for help. His father gave him a job, but it was the one the young Grant swore he never wanted, working in a leather shop. Then things took a surprising turn. The Civil War began. The Union needed experienced military leaders. Grant accepted a position leading a difficult group of troops. He was able to train them and earn their respect. Quickly, Grant's public image as a military leader grew. He won major victories for the Union in battles at Fort Donelson, Tennessee, and Vicksburg, Mississippi. The president at the time, Abraham Lincoln, liked the way Grant planned the battles. He also liked that Grant did everything he could to win. Grant permitted so many of his soldiers to die that his critics gave him a nickname, the Butcher. Grant's methods were harsh, but effective. The Civil War effectively ended when the famous Confederate general, Robert E. Lee, surrendered to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia. The following year, Grant was named General of the U.S. Armies. The only other person to hold that position was the military leader during the Revolutionary War, George Washington.
Thank you.
Like George Washington, Grant became president, although he did not really seek the position. But Republican Party leaders realized that the former general was very popular, and they knew that Grant opposed the policies of the president at the time, Andrew Johnson. So the Republicans nominated Grant as their candidate in 1868. He won easily. But Grant's popularity and ability as a military leader did not make him a successful president. Grant tried to work for the political and civil rights of African Americans, many of whom had been enslaved. One of Grant's most important acts was to support the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The measure gave African American men the right to vote. At the same time, Grant tried to give states control over their own laws. So, sometimes he used the power of the federal government to protect the rights of African Americans, and he sometimes let states use violence to prevent African Americans from exercising their rights. Grant also spoke about treating Native Americans with greater respect. He used government resources to help Native people become farmers. But other government policies helped white settlers continue to push tribes off their lands. Few Native Americans saw their lives really improve under Grant. Finally, his administration suffered because of corrupt government officials. Grant himself did not get rich from their actions, but he remained loyal to people who worked for him, even when they profited from their position. As a result of all this, many Americans lost interest in Reconstruction and lost faith in the federal government. But Grant himself remained popular. He won a second term more easily than the first. Shortly after, the country entered a bad economic depression. Grant tried to improve the situation by supporting the gold standard, but many Americans, of all backgrounds, continued to suffer. Because of the problems in his government, Grant is not remembered as one of the country's best presidents. But he is remembered as a war hero and as a kind-hearted man with an interesting life. In his last months, Grant worked nearly nonstop on writing his memoirs. Final images show him covered in a blanket and with a pen in his hand, diligently working. Grant died in 1885, a few days after the book was finished. It was a major success. It earned enough money to provide for his family for the rest of their lives. People across the country mourned the loss of Grant. More than 1.5 million watched his funeral parade in New York City. He is buried there, along with his beloved wife, in a well-known memorial, popularly called Grant's Tomb. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.